Our second lesson on critical theory. And what we want to do tonight is just kind of look at the foundations or what's behind critical theory. Everything we say has something behind it, or there is a foundation behind what we say. And so often we're, as Christians, we evaluate a statement or we evaluate a truth claim as if facts or reality just hang in the air. They're just hanging there and they're not connected to anything else. And we're just evaluating what we believe just based upon if the statement sounds good or if we like it. And not really questioning what's behind that statement? Where does that statement come from? And what's the foundation of that statement? It's amazing in the church how much we've brought in secular thinking into the church, because we're not even thinking about what is behind those statements. What's the foundation? And that last time we spoke 2 weeks ago, I wanted to make it clear that every worldview has three legs that holds it up. And every truth claim, there's going to be at least three fundamental pillars that that truth claim hangs upon. And that is the foundation of that truth claim. And what are those three pillars? We talked about ontology, what exists. We looked at epistemology, how we know what we know. And then we look at ethics. What's right and wrong? Those three questions are the foundation behind all philosophies and behind all religion. And you can't not answer those questions. You can't go, well, I don't know about those questions, but I do believe this. But you got to realize what you're saying you believe in is founded on one of those foundations. And so we as Christians need to think through things from a biblical worldview. We need to have the ability to assess positions. I mean, this comes in handy when you think about politics. It comes in handy when we think about all kinds of things, especially counseling. And we want to look at the foundation behind critical theory. What is the foundation? What are the three questions? What do they believe exist? Ontology. How do they know what they know? What's their view of epistemology? And what is their ethics? Well, the foundation of critical theory, which comes from, is Marxism and social Marxism. Or we could say classical Marxism and social Marxism. In fact, we'll see that classical Marxism and social Marxism are essentially the same thing, but they stress different things. And Marxism is the foundation. And for right now, you're just going to have to take my word for it. I'm making an assertion that I'm going to prove a little bit tonight, but I'm going to thoroughly prove 2 weeks from now that critical theory, which is the foundation from critical race theory, critical gay theory, critical, all the critical theories. When we think about identity politics, Black Lives Matter, social justice, all these things that are being tossed around on Facebook and are being used in the political scene, all these things that are very relevant in our culture today finds their foundation in critical theory, and critical theory founds its foundation in Marxism. Now, when we think about Marxism, which is what we're going to talk about tonight, and I know you're here, I don't care about Marxism. Well, at least indulge me tonight and say, I want to learn about Marxism, Jeff. I want to know about it. Tell me what it is. And more importantly, we want to know what is the foundations behind Marxism. What do they believe is ultimate reality, ontology? What is real? What's ultimate? You know, in philosophy, the question is, you know, is mind or matter? You remember that, you know, which is more important? Which was first, mind or matter? We believe mind. God exists as a spirit, and the physical property of the universe was created after God. So we put mind as ultimate, or the spiritual realm as ultimate, do we not? That's the biblical worldview. But atheists, they put matter, right? They put the world, the physical, above mind. So that's an ontological question, which is ultimate. Epistemology. How do we know what we know? Well, determining how we answer if there's a God or not, mind or matter, how we answer that will shape, well, I'll put it this way, will determine how we think we know what we know. And then those two questions, how we answer them, will shape or determine how we behave, or at least our guide to ethics and morality. And you see, I have this circle with this triangle in it. How you answer one of these questions determines, not just influences, determines the how you answer the other two. It doesn't matter which one you begin with. It forces you, that, if you're going to be logically consistent, to answer the other two in relationship to how you answer the first. And I really believe that Darwinism and materialism and naturalism, we'll get into that in a minute, all came from a commitment to science first. Their epistemology led them to atheism, because they took it as a presupposition that you can only know what science teaches you. And if science can't teach you or doesn't reveal it, if your empirical senses does not discern it, then you can't know it, which leads to atheism, because your senses cannot see or discern God. So they started with this kind of this pre-commitment, this epistemological commitment to science as the ultimate test of reality. And it led to atheism. We'll get into that a little bit, which once you come to that conclusion, it leads to relativism in your ethics. And so the three pillars, the three fundamental pillars to Marxism are these: materialism, positivism, I'll tell you what that is in a minute, and relativism. These are the props that hold up Marxism. And that means if you take these pillars out, Marxism falls apart. Marxism cannot hold up. You can't take Marxism and the principles of Marxism and put them on the Christian worldview pillars. You can't. They're not compatible. This is why Marxism, Marxism is not just a system of economics that we're free to agree or disagree upon. This is not just about economics. This is a worldview conflict at the very heart. And the pillars of Marxism, materialism, positivism, and relativism, are antithetical to the Christian worldviews. They're enemies to each other. Now, how do they get to this place? Well, the watershed moment in history come about in the 19th century. He may be kind of the biggest name in philosophy and science, because everything changed after him. This man, Charles Darwin. The thing about Charles Darwin, what you may not know, before his studies and before his experimentations, before he went and studied the bird beaks and spiders and things of that nature, he was already, before his investigation, was a convinced materialist. He was convinced of empiricism, that science is the only way you can know anything. And so that rules out God as a solution. Now, Darwin didn't necessarily say that there's no God. He just said we can't use God as a possible solution for why there's something in this world. That can't be a solution. So we have to find a materialistic solution to the existence of materialism. That is, the world has to be able to explain itself, which it can't do, by the way. We know it can't do that. There has to be something outside the world to explain why the world exists. But Darwin, before his studies, was looking for a materialistic solution to the problem of why there's something rather than nothing. And he observed slight adaptations to the species, and he went from that, which is actually a true scientific fact, species within themselves have slight adaptations. There's no problem about that. But he concluded that all species originated from the single cell. And it was just speculation. It was just like working from this premise and all the way back. And the thing about it, it's really not a convincing theory. However, it was at least an explanation that atheists finally had. They finally had a scientific theory or at least an explanation to help strengthen their convinced presupposition of empiricism. And basically, well, you know what empiricism is, right? Empiricism is that you can only know what the empirical senses, your five senses, detect. And empiricism leads to materialism, that nothing exists except matter in its movements and modifications. And that's materialism. Sometimes it's called naturalism. That matter comes first. And that's all there is. Remember Carl Sagan, he says, the universe is all there is. And this leads to the conclusion that matter comes before mind. Think about the evolutional process. It was, you know, it's a lifeless matter. There's no joy. There's no love. There's no reproduction. There's no anything. There's no feelings. There's no soul. There's no thought. Just matter. Raw matters. All there was. That's how it all began. And somehow, matter produced the soul, the psyche, love, emotions, all these things, which is impossible. We know it's impossible. But see, the problem of evolution, it is not only opposed to the Bible for the obvious reason that it goes against Genesis, the creation story of seven-day creation. And that's usually how people attack evolution. But you know, there's people like Tim Keller, who's an evolutionist, a Christian evolutionist. Which, what's sad about it is not just like he has to allegorize Genesis 1 through 3. That's not the only problem he has. He has to say that the soul is a byproduct of matter. And that goes against the biblical account that God breathed into the dust that he formed, a living soul, that God breathed into them. And so you don't, in humanity, you don't have matter, then the soul. You have body and soul together. Not one before the other, but they come together. And they're separate. That's an important biblical distinction to help us to judge a lot of the secular thinking today, is to keep the body and soul different and make sure that you believe that the soul is eternal from God. And we'll see in a minute, it'll affect our understanding of morality and sin. Okay, if you are an evolutionist, you have to come to the conclusion in some type of materialistic empiricism. Now, I believe they used empiricism to come to evolution, but nevertheless, if you answered the question of the God question in the negative, there's no God, well, you have to come to the conclusion that matter is first. Matter is before the mind. And thus, if it shapes your epistemology. How do you know what you know? And empiricism says that we're all born with a tabula rasa, a blank slate. Ever heard that? Is it nature or nurture debate? You may remember that debate. That's a big debate in psychology, nature or nurture. They all say nurture, nurture, nurture. Well, because they believe that humans, babies are born innocent. You know, there's no knowledge, there's no absolute law. The law of God is not written on your conscience. You're not born with any built-in knowledge. You don't know anything until your five senses collect data and information, and then you process that data, and then comes knowledge. And thus, all knowledge is based upon empiricism or your senses. And so you don't know anything. You're just a blank slate, empty vessel, and you're innocent, you're ignorant, innocent, and you're going to be shaped by your culture, by your nurture, by your parents, by society. Your society is going to mess you up, not yourself. That's key. Society is to blame, not you. Well, this type of empiricism leads to, which was in vogue during the 19th century and 20th century, positivism. Hardly anybody will claim to be a positivist now. And that's why you may have never heard of this word, because that's social Marxism has rejected positivism. But classical Marxism was built upon this. And that is a philosophy system, a philosophical system that holds that every rational, justifiable assertion can be scientifically verified or is capable of logical or mathematical proof, and that therefore rejects metaphysics and theisms. So what is not a logical demonstrating proof or what can't be verified by science has to be rejected. The only problem, the reason no one believes in positivism anymore, is someone come along and says, I don't think science or logic necessarily demands that. So it's self-refuting. Science doesn't prove this. So they had to reject it. Like they're saying something that goes directly against what they're trying to prove. But one of the leading guys, empiricists, that come to this view of positivism was William Clifford, who was a contemporary of Darwin, says, it is wrong always and everywhere and for everyone to believe anything upon insufficient evidence. That's why Bertrand Russell says, whatever knowledge is attainable must be attained by the scientific method, and what science cannot discover, man cannot know. So that rules out God and a lot of other things. Well, that's part of the epistemological system of Marxism, but there was another empiricist that influenced Marxism. And this is a guy that predates Charles Darwin, but he was already without the Darwinistic evolutionary theory. This guy, this philosopher, was a convinced empiricist. In fact, he was one of the leading empiricists, one of the fathers of empiricism, and that is Hegel. Hegel believed that how we come to know things is that you have a statement, it's kind of a theory, like a thesis, okay, I think that this is true. But then the opposite, someone's going to go, well, I don't know if that's true or not. It's an antithesis, okay? So they're a conflict statement. And then there's a synthesis of like, okay, well, maybe there's a little bit of truth here and a little bit of truth there. Then you synthesize this, and then you're moving to a closer truth. And that synthesis becomes the new thesis. Then that thesis is contradicted or challenged with the antithesis. Then there's a new thesis. And it just keeps working. And that's called the dialectic theory of knowledge. That we're gaining truth. We don't start with it. We're working our way to it. It's a rejection of absolutes, a divine God who reveals our instincts, our intuitive knowledge, or the law of God written on the heart. It rejects all that. It begins with empiricism. But as we move throughout culture and society, we're progressively gaining truth. And when you hear progressivism in politics, you know they're talking about Hegelianism. It's talking about this theory that truth, we're not yet there. It's still relative, right? We're really never going to get to it, but we're progressively getting closer. And the further we are in history, the smarter we are. Thus, we have to reject those who have gone before us. And that's why progressivism doesn't like a document, if it's the Bible or the Constitution or any other old document, because they could not have known, right? It could not be sufficient. It's not sufficient to tell us in our modern day how we should marry. Are the issues that they were way more advanced and progressive than they were back then. And so it's really a rejection of history and in favor of truth going forward. But nevertheless, you can see how relative it is. It's based upon relativism. And that leads to, you know, if you reject God and you have to reject a divine revelation that comes from outside the cosmos to us, from into our conscience, through the law written in our hearts, or through the Bible, you come to the conclusion that then you come to some type of a materialistic ethics. And let me be honest with you. You study ethics in the university today, you're not getting any absolute divine absolutes anymore. You're getting materialistic relativism. And you may say, well, that's silly. Relativism is self-defeating. You know, who's to say, if you believe in relativism, who's to say that statement's right? And we think we're clever in saying that, right? We think we defeated you. But these people are not convinced by that type of shallow rebuke. They're not. Because they're convinced that, hey, relativism has to be true if there's no God. And if you base your knowledge on purely empiricism, and I'm not rejecting the use of your senses, but if it's founded on your senses completely, then you have to come to the conclusion of relativism. And this destroys the biblical worldview completely because, one, it starts off with a member of a blank slate that man is innocent. He's born ignorant and innocent. You know, it's not like babies are born speaking lies from the womb, like the Bible teaches us. Inherent depravity that they receive from their parents. And you don't have to teach your kids to steal, to lie, and to be selfish. They come out selfish. That's their disposition. So it's a denial of that, a denial of depravity, but it also leads to that man is just a machine. That mind and their little hearts and their little, you know, emotional disposition is just a byproduct of physics and materialism. If you don't believe that that's what they believe, read this quote by Bertrand Russell. And in fact, I'm going to send you, if you want these quotes, you can have them. I'm not going to read them. I'm just going to summarize them. Bertrand Russell says, if you're driving your car and it breaks down on the side of the road, it says you don't get out of your car and kick the tires and go, bad car. It's just a machine. And if you have a kid that's stealing or cheating or hurting other kids, you shouldn't come out and discipline that kid or go to your kid and say, bad kid. Just as your car has some type of mechanical problem, a physical problem, there's something physically wrong with your car, the same thing is true with your kid. He says, of course, you may need to stop your kid from hurting some other kid. You may need to restrain that kid and prevent the kid from doing that. But you don't need to chastise them and look down upon your kid. There's something physically wrong. Well, that's just materialism. That's evolution. No wonder, you know, Sigmund Freud, who had the same pillars of his philosophy, a rejection of God, an atheist, an empiricist, a relativistic, rejected that man was born morally sinful. Man is innocent. babies are innocent and they're just a machine. And when there's moral problems, those problems need to be addressed physically, not spiritually. He rejected religion altogether as a solution to people's depravity, or he wouldn't call it depravity, to moral deviance. And he believed that the body, the brain, needed fixing. And from his theories, I mean, practice all the way up into the 70s, people with mental illnesses would be shocked. Electro treatment. I had clients in my old job that could remember going into the facilities and they would have their brains slightly electrocuted. And they would talk to me about, they would tell me about the painful experience it was. Because the theory was there's something physically wrong with your brain. There's not a behavioral issue that has to be corrected. There's not something spiritually wrong, because they reject that as a possibility. What's wrong is the chemicals in your brain. You hear that today. Even people in churches talking about, you know, they'll go get see a psychiatrist and they go, oh, I have a chemical imbalance. That's evolution. And you go and ask, well, what chemicals are you talking about? What chemicals actually? I mean, there are, and I'm not a doctor, and I know that there's a lot of things that can be deficient in someone's body. You know, there's vitamin D, there's a lot of things that you need to evaluate, and a physical doctor can look at these things. And so, and I understand the body and the soul are intertwined. And I know if you're not eating right, it can affect you. And I know there's sleeping issues. I understand all that. I'm not completely denying that there's physical aspects to our emotions. But I reject the idea that man's fundamental problem is a physical problem with a rejection of any responsibility. And that's why psychiatrists, they don't put blame on the individual. They make them feel better. It's like, you can't help this. You have a mental illness. Your kids not behaving? Well, it's because of they're going to get a diagnosis, which is an excuse, right? It's just an excuse. They're like, I understand. My kid's got this diagnosis. What about a sin problem? What about a God problem? What about a selfishness problem? What about a disobedience problem? What about no self-control problem? What about these type of things? Well, they're rejected. Sigmund Freud. Listen, he said the body is made up of an unconscious part, your psyche, your soul. In fact, the word psychology is a substitute word for soul, and it was invented by another German psychologist to be a replacement for the word religion. But within that psyche, Sigmund Freud said there's basically three things that the soul is made up of, which is basically a byproduct of the physical matter and the chemicals within your brain. You have the id, and that's your unconsciousness. And in your unconsciousness, you have just these impulses, needs. And Sigmund Freud was very sick. He was, everything to him was about sex, and that's all I'll say about him. But you have all these needs of the unconsciousness that need to be satisfied. All the, you know, I call them lust. Longings of the depraved soul. You know, the things that you want to fulfill, satisfy. And lust is not necessarily always a bad word. It just means a strong appetite or desire. And that's how the scripture uses the word lust. He put these lust as you have these basic needs that is part of the unconscious soul. You're born, you know, with these, you know, and this is part of the evolutional process that you, of the survival of the fittest. You've got to have these things to survive, to reproduce, and to keep genetics going. This is part of evolution that has put these in you. That's the id. Then you have the ego, which is your parenting or its culture. It's the norms of society. It's telling you, hey, you can't do that. You can't just eat anytime you want. You can't just behave that way. You can't just act out these impulses and lusts and desires because, one, people are going to look down upon you, right? And two, it's a no-no. You're going to get in trouble. You may go to prison. So you got the ego, which is the conscious part of you trying to rein down and suppress the id. And then you got the superego, and that's half conscious, half unconscious, and that's where the war is going on. Who's going to win? Culture or my lust? And listen, Sigmund Freud believed. Because if you don't have a God, who's to say sex before marriage is sinful? Animals do it. If evolution is a part of the process, then all of a sudden we've been, according to Freud, we've been duped into this false morality, which is causing us to feel guilt, and that is a confliction, and this superego is just torn apart when he shouldn't be. And this is a form of oppression. It's very sick what Freud did, but he turned evil into good and good into evil. There's no depravity. There's no God that tells us about sexual morality and what it's to look like. Basically, your kids need to be able to not feel oppressed and conflicted from within. And they get this, they get this conflict of their souls, not from within them, but from culture. Not nature, but nurture. They come up with a blank slate, and all the human problems and mental problems and problems in society comes from the cultural construct that wrecks these kids that come adult. That's the problem. So all of a sudden, if you take away God, you've got to understand, you take away God, you're reshuffling the very foundations of the worldview. You're changing everything and turning everything up on its head. Now, what is the standard? Okay, now you got to decide there's no God and everything's materialistic and that determines how I know what I know and everything is relative. Well, what's right and wrong? What's my ethics? Well, it destroys universal absolutes. Obviously it destroys that. And relativism is basically based upon materialism or evolution. And I talked about this in my sermon Sunday, and I used the word determinism. It's not divine providence. We have a divine God with a mind that's purposely choosing how things are going to turn out. This is just physics determining how things turn out. Determinism leads to fatalism because determinism says everything operates based upon physics. And we may roll the dice and there's so many factors of how the dice is going to land, we can't predict. Too many factors for us. For us, it's luck. But it's not really lucky compared if you look at the physics behind it. There's always a reason how much strength you use, the air resistance, the landing, and all these things come into place. And if you knew all the factors, you could determine how the dice is going to land every time, if you knew that. Well, what determined the robe may have been determined what you ate, and what you ate might be determined by where you were born, and all this is determined by another physical law, and it really goes back to the Big Bang. And determinism says when physics happened, when matter came out of nothing, that moment, it not only determined the spacing of the stars and the universe and the solar systems, not only were that all determined at once, but everything else throughout history was determined then. Which means that in the end, everything's fixed. And it doesn't matter how you or I feel about it. It leads to fatalism, which also leads to the philosophy that was famous is somewhat still famous in France, nihilism, which means nothing really matters. It doesn't matter how we live. It is going to be what it is. So basically, do what you want. You know, eat, drink, tomorrow you're going to die. Just enjoy your life. There's no purpose. There's no meaning. Everything's an accident. There's no meaning to life. And if there's no meaning in life, there's no reason to do anything. There's no motivation, really long-term motivation, other than just satisfy your senses. That's where hedonism comes in. You know, just live for self, live for now, live for the moment. And listen, nihilism is very depressing, and it leads people to kind of go, man, I don't know if I like that. I don't like where science leads me if there's no God. I don't like that. And so during this time, if this is your foundation, and you don't want to come to the conclusion that life is meaningless or there's no ethics, what can you do? Well, that's where existentialism comes in. I know you're on ism. I can't keep up with all this. Existentialism is born out of atheism. And I know I hear people say, I'm a Christian existentialist. I just don't say, you don't know what you're talking about. You have no idea what you're saying. Existentialism, the basic meaning of this is meaning is after matter. Matter before meaning. You know, in my mind, the hammer, someone knew what he was trying to do and had the purpose of the hammer in his mind before he designed and created the hammer. So the hammer existed in the mind before it existed in reality. And that's the way we believe. God had something in his mind before it came into existence. And he's the one who determines, because it was his mental conception, what things are. You are a male. Right? And the male identity, masculinity, is determined by the mind before the matter. And the matter corresponds with its purpose. But existentialism says, hey, we exist by accident. There's no meaning. There's no purpose. Therefore, we get to create meaning for ourselves. Right? I get to determine the meaning for me. That's truth for you, but that's not my truth. I determine my own truth. I get to write the definitions. You know, you may say, that's true. That's why, you know, this is where the gay movement leads. You're like, I don't like to be a male. I can be a woman if I want to. Who's to say I can't? I determine this. This is existentialism. And the first one to really develop existentialism was the contemporary of Darwin and Freud. In fact, he was a friend of Freud, Friedrich Nietzsche. I read every book by Nietzsche, and I think he's an evil, evil man. Nietzsche says, okay, he says, God is dead. That's what he's famous for saying. God is dead. But now that he's dead, and it changes everything, we can't just, you know, again, this is not just saying, let's just change the system a little bit. Let's kind of like adjust things. This is a complete rejection of the foundations and rethinking completely outside of the box. He says, we can't look to God to give us meaning and definitions and morality. Where do we look? Well, we have to look within. We have to look to ourselves. And Friedrich Nietzsche, being a convinced Darwinism, in fact, Nietzsche was in seminary going to be a Lutheran pastor when he came to the writings of Darwin, rejected Christianity and then rejected God. And that's the same thing with Stalin. Stalin was in seminary, came to the writings of Darwin's The Origins of Species, and he rejected Christianity and accepted Marxism. Well, Friedrich Nietzsche says, okay, we have to look to science. In fact, we have to look to evolution. He got the survival of the fittest. And that became kind of the motif of his ethics. Well, we look at how we got here. Thus, that must be science. Thus, that's what we should be doing. We should be striving to improve ourselves. He wrote the book Overman, which is where we get, he coined the word Overman, German, which means Superman. We should seek a superior race. That's why Adolf Hitler was Friedrich Nietzsche's disciple. and sought to implement that with the Aryan race. Now, hey, our goal is to eliminate the weak, the feeble, the handicapped, those who are inferior. And we should do our best to create a new super race of people. Okay, that's option one. I want to say that because that's existentialism, finding morality out of science. Existential, meaning after existence. Well, that's option one. That's rejected by Marxism. The option two is Karl Marx existentialism. This is where Karl Marx comes into play. He had to come up with a theory of meaning and purpose and activism. I mean, it's like, okay, if we're just an accident, what can we do? Well, that's a depressing philosophy. How do we get hope? Well, he came up with communism. And again, based upon Freud and the theory of evolution that the heart's not the problem, depravity is not the problem, there's not a sin problem with God, there's not guilt within, that's we eliminate that, then man's problems, the evils of the world, come not from within, but from society structures, by culture. We've got to change the culture. And look where history has brought us. It's brought us to these wars. It's brought us to these fights and class divisions. And we're warring among nations. We're warring among ourselves. The rich look down upon the poor. The poor are envious of the rich. We get all this division. The Bible says, where do wars and fighting come from with you? Does it not, from among you? Does it not come from with you that you covet, you lust? You know, it's an inward problem, right? That's the Bible solution. Mark says, you know, we rule that out. It's not an inward problem. It's a society problem. And Karl Marx says, if we study history, we study basically it's always about oppression. He says the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. Now, this statement here is the foundation of his ethics. Freeman and slave, lord and serf, guild master and journeyman, in a word, oppressor and oppressed. Now, if you want to know the ethics of Marxism, the ethics of atheism in this existential position, is you have oppressed and the oppressor. Now, Friedrich Nietzsche says the strong need to oppress the weak. He went the opposite. Marx says, no, that's the problem. That's what's happened. And that's the reason the world's all messed up. Now, if we're going to create utopia, a better world, and solve the sin problem, it's a religion. Get rid of guilt, God. Take God's out of the equation. You don't have guilt. You don't have to worry about if you're a sexual immoral person. And that's the truth today, right? You don't have to. If you're sexually immoral, that's not the problem. But if you're a racist, that'll get you thrown out. But you can have all types of other sins. You're exempt from that criticism. But if you're part of this superstructure of the oppressed oppressing the oppressor oppressing the oppressed, then that is a moral sin. That's systemic. It's not about changing individual racism. It's just about changing the infrastructure of capitalism that has existed since mankind existed. And Marx actually is basically saying you can look at all the different flows of societies, but every one of them have been capitalistic. Every one of them has been hierarchical structure of authority. There's going to have people with authority and people under authority. That's the problem. Parents who have authority are over their children who are under authority. You always have oppression. You have the superego who's oppressed, or the id that is oppressed by the ego, which is shaped by the superego culture. That's basically the foundation of Marxism. Atheistic relativism and Marxism. Okay, I'm looking at the time because I'm trying to think. I'm going long. Let me buzz through this. What's the objective of classical Marxism? Five objectives. Now, these are not me reading into this. These are stated objectives. Get rid of property. Get rid of the family, or the nuclear family, as we know the Bible describes it. Get rid of private education, nationality, and religion. That's the goal of Marxism. It is not just an economic system that differs from capitalism. It's a philosophy that is attacking the very nature of society that God has established. It's an attack upon God. It's a godless religion seeking to undo what God has established. Well, you say, how do you know that this is their objective? Well, because they state it very clearly. I've read for the third time, in fact, for the study, I bought a fresh copy because I had a rabbit that ate my first copy of the Communist Manifesto. No joke, he ate the thing to pieces. But I didn't mind. It's one of the worst books I've ever read. It's an evil book. It's a demonic book. It's a godless book. The Communist Manifesto, written by Karl Marx and his friend Engels. The immediate aim of the communists is the same as that of the other proletarian working class parties. Formation of the masses into a class, overthrow of the ruling class, the conquest of political power by the working class. Basically goes on to that they want to get rid of private property. You can read that there. Get rid of the family. Now, this is in the Communist Manifesto. Abolition of the family, even the most radical flare-up of this infamous proposal of the communists. On what foundation is the present family, the ruling family, is based on capital, on private gain? And so they go on to say that, listen, the nuclear family is based upon capitalism, and it's based upon a hierarchical structure of a male-dominant leader who rules his family, which oppresses the wife and the children. And again, the heart of this problem is you have, from Freud, you have this idea of culture oppressing the id, and the id needs to be free. And this is why they call it the Liberation Party. You've got to free the id. You've got to let depravity be unshackled and do what it wants and quit suppressing it, because you're going to hurt the little minds and stunt their growth and make them conflicted, and it's going to twist them all up. And this is all basically rooted in the family. This is where it all begins. And I think God actually did that. The family is the one who teaches the kids morality. I mean, that's the goal of the family, is to tell the little depraved souls, stop it. Don't do that. You can't think this way. Quit thinking that way. You know, there can be devious thinking in little kids. And the best thing you can do is say, that's abnormal. That's sick. Don't think that way. But now, if kids, even young kids, have weird, crazy thoughts that come out of nowhere, you're going to have psychiatrists claim it. You're gay. That's okay. You think you're a girl? That's okay. I'm not to tell you who you are. And in some countries, if you tell your kid that they're a boy and they are a boy, your kids can be taken away from you. This is where this is going, brothers and sisters. Next thing, it talks about how to accomplish this, we have to get the education out of the home. And put it, you have to centralize education. Basically, we need to tell your kids, instruct your kids, not the family. It says, and your education is not that also social and determined by social conditions under which you educate, by the intervention direct and or indirect of society, by the means of schools. The communists have not invented the intervention of society in education. They do not but seek to alter the character of the intervention and to rescue education from the influence of the ruling class. They want to get rid of nationality. You know, this, I mean, you got class warfare, then you have national warfare. You know, you got the haves and the have-nots, the strong nations against the weak nations. You got to get rid of all these classes globally. And they admit that communism can't function without it being a global initiative. And in fact, this very quote talks about that, that the only way this can work is if all the major industrious countries come together under communism. And they still today think Russia failed because it wasn't a global thing. It's not about it failing on its own terms, but because it wasn't implemented globally. Obviously, in their catechism, in the communist catechism written by Engels, what will be the attitude to existing religions? All religions so far have been the expression of historical stages of development of individual peoples or group of peoples. But communism is the stage of historical development which makes all existing religions superfluous and brings about their disappearance. This is the end goal. Now, how do they want to implement this? Well, the Communist Manifesto, if you read that at the end, it says, okay, this is how we do it. Now, how Lenin and Stalin did it, they disagree with that. That's a ruling power bringing everybody in subjection. That's kind of the opposite of what they wanted to happen. They wanted the working class to rise up, the masses to willfully, freely choose this philosophy of their own accord. And it's only when the working class does it, is it a government of the people. And it's a collective decision of the masses, not just a few ruling people making this decision for them. But they have 10 things that needs to happen for the masses to slowly develop this. Get rid of private property by huge taxations, heavy progressive gradual income tax, to get rid of all inheritance, the right of inheritance, have a centralized banking system, get rid of local banks, centralized communication, basically centralize everything. Free education for all children, public schools, all these things. You can read those things. This is the way they wanted to implement it. Now, I'll say this in kind of as I'm trying to wrap this up and trying to take a lot of knowledge. I'm skipping over here at the end, but they really believe, Karl Marx believed, because he believed in Hegel's thesis, antithesis, synthesis, that we're in a stage of history that communism is the next phase and it's going to happen on its own. And all we need to assist it to happen, we need to push for it, but we're about to see this. He actually thought this was going to happen regardless of what people wanted or not, or regardless of what we thought, this was naturally happen, because he saw that we're starting to see in his day that everybody's oppressed, and what you have to, people have to see that they're oppressed, and once they recognize they're oppressed, the majority of people are oppressed by a few people, and when the majority see that they're oppressed, they're going to rise up and establish this new order of society that eliminates authority structure. A hierarchical authority structures are going to be eliminated, and then you're going to have utopia. Well, as we get into next week, we'll look at how Marxism breeds or brought about critical theory. And I'll say, just kind of to whet our appetite for 2 weeks from now, critical theory and social justice was born out of Marxism. I'm not saying it's just similar things. Well, they have similar characteristics. I'm saying dogmatically, and I'll do my best to prove it next week or 2 weeks from now. Dogmatically, critical theory is Marxism. It's social Marxism. We'll show the difference next week. It is social Marxism. Critical theory is an epistemological theory based upon relativism. You know, it basically says knowledge is impossible. It's critical of everything. That's where the word critical comes from. It's like, okay, we have to reevaluate that, reevaluate the family, reevaluate language and communication, and even language is oppressive. They say that. Such as, you're a boy. I'm not speaking to a boy. You're a boy. That's oppressive. That's language. And they say language is only a social construct. Words and meaning only have meaning based upon how you were raised and what those words mean to that people group and to that class of people that you may be involved in. And so that's true, maybe true for them, but that necessarily means it's real. So there's really, you can't know what truth is. So this is where the critical theory comes into play. We'll talk more about that later. Secondly, the objective of critical theory is the implementation of Marxism. Critical theory came about in the 30s in a school in Frankfurt, Germany, in the 1930s. As Hitler was coming to power, there was a school started in Frankfurt. And it was based upon four professors who were all committed to Marxism. That was the common thing they all agreed with. And whether there's a professor of philosophy, a professor of history, a professor of psychology. And all these professors all were Marxists. And the objective of the school was, how do we, because they're seeing what's going on in Russia and they disagree with how it was implemented. Not with the actual communism, but how it came about. And they're saying, how do we bring about our philosophy, Marxism? And they put together a 100-year plan, a plan bigger than they, a plan that they didn't know if they would see accomplished when they were dead, before they did. Okay, this has got to be a long-term initiative. And the goal is to get the working-class people to accept it, to demand it, to want it. And you've got to get the masses buying into it. It's a religion with its own ethics, with no God. And listen to the founder of the Frankfurt School, the leading man behind critical theory. This is what he says. The revolution won't happen with guns. Rather, it will happen incrementally, year by year, generation by generation. We will gradually infiltrate their educational institutions. They've done that. And their political offices. They just did that last night. Transforming them slowly into Marxist entities as we move towards universal egalitarianism. You know what egalitarianism is? That's feminism. That's no hierarchical system of authority. That's what communism, everybody does what's right in their own eyes, and there's no authority. It's not individualism. It's not, you know, some hierarchical authority telling us. It's this, if you get rid of, you know, if you change the structure of our culture, we're not going to have any oppressor, and we're all going to do what's right. We're not going to have the sin problem or the ethical problems, because it's a cultural problem. And that's why cultural Marxism, social justice, critical race theory, they're not worried about you being a racist. It's systemic. It's in capitalism. It's the system. That's the problem. Next week, we'll go, 2 weeks from now, we'll go and just take a closer look at these founding fathers of critical theory. And then we'll look at critical theory more deeply. Then after that, we'll look at some of the the babies that are born from that, Black Lives Matter and so forth, critical race theory and things of that nature. We'll look at these things. So let's pray. And I want to say a word of encouragement. I'm thankful that God's on the throne. All right, let's pray. Dear Lord, we see that the devil's at work with these false religions based upon a non-God, relativism, thinking that there's no sin, no guilt. Everything's a cultural problem. Everything is just, and no doubt there's cultural problems, but that's because there's sin. It's because there's depravity. Lord, we're thankful that you have the solution. It's called regeneration. You have the solution in sending your Son to bring in a new kingdom where dwells righteousness, and you're going to one day give us a new heavens and a new earth that we can actually have true utopia. Thank you for what you did in your Son. And thank you for, Lord, the hierarchical system that you set in place in nature with a husband and a wife and a man that rules over his family, that is to instruct their family in the ways of righteousness and the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Thank you for the home that you have established. Thank you for Christianity, a real religion. Thank you for the book that gives us absolutes, gives us purpose and meaning. It's not determinism, but it's predestination and providence. It's just much glorious. Thank you for the biblical realities that we live in. This we pray in your Son's name. Amen.